Now let's get a little disciplined about all of this, yeah? And we have to make some basic decisions on how to operate at this moment, to be fair. And I want to avoid pleasant conversations and a little, you know, that you would normally have, what you say is extremely interesting and very important. I want the conversation when you get somewhere, you feel made some progress, and that may require some challenge. The big decision is, shall we operate in small groups or in a large group? The pros and cons, and advantage in a small group is you have more airtime. The advantage of being all together, we're all together here, and as one of you said, that you can use more groups at another time. Because I really am interested to connect you with this material in some meaningful way, and what I need is some real issues that you are bringing up. It takes a while to present them. So my preference would be to, my thought would be that we should stick together in this group.
Yes.
It'll get, it's probably difficult to be really productive in small groups right now. Mm. But you're the guy who's in charge of all of this.
No, I think it's everybody agrees.
Yes.
See, just listening to people talk makes me, I'm going to assume that you've read this material now that's there, those four pages, and not going to any exposition, but I want you to get a feeling for how this would be used to put a business together. And I want to challenge you not to tell me your story, or not to tell me what's going on and what works and what doesn't work, but cut through that and challenge you right away by asking you, what kind of decisions do you have to make right now to get to the next level of success in where you are? Not just tell your story, which is wonderful and which is nice and we all like to do and need to do and deserve to do, but given the constriction of time, what are some of the decisions that you, after you've told your story, what are some of the decisions that you're going to have to make now to make a difference? And those decisions are of a different order. They mean that free will and systems are outside of your mind, and you use your mind for that. For example, it means, first of all, you have to find the deeper issues that are involved in there. It's not, we're trying to do a lot of problem solving, fixing things that aren't working. But maybe what's needed is a new car, not one that's constantly being fixed up. Maybe you got to just raise the house and start again. Maybe you need to move to a new neighborhood or something bigger to make a decision that really makes a difference. No more micromanaging. No more fixing a little bit here, fixing a little bit there. What are some of the deeper issues that are not being addressed, that are being missed by what we have? And I wonder whether you could just volunteer, think of a problem that you have. Jump one step. Think of an issue that you have in business, and people have already talked to me about them. They're good. And in order to get to the next step of growth, what needs to change in how you approach that situation to make a difference? And here's some thoughts that I want you to take seriously in that. And they have to do with that whole system. And you can read these passages if you want to continue more, but we don't have time to now go into detail. First of all, always ask yourselves, from whose point of view are you going to make this analysis? It's always a subjectivity who's analyzing it. And if you talk in generalities, then the ego that is going to make a decision is sort of factored out. Unless there's an ego involved somewhere in there, that ego really has to be you. I have to make certain decisions about this situation, and here are the decisions that I can make. Mostly people will talk about things they cannot change. Well, fine. If those things cannot be changed by you, what decision are you going to make? Micromanage or macromanage? So, first is, from whose point of view are you going to talk about it? from the society's point of view, from your personal point of view, from some groups of people, from the special interest point of view, from whose point of view. And then, are you going to act, are you going to look for your own individual interests? Or are you going to work for what you may consider the betterment of society? And those are okay, those two decisions. They're separate. You live in a continent where there are many, many countries that have different ways of being. You know the United States, you know other nations in the world, you know Latin America, Africa, Asia, Middle East, you know, you're familiar with all of these cultures. Maybe some of those do a better job than what you want to be doing. So try to get to some basic decisions here that have to be made, and what's your connection with what has to be made. I think if Obama were to do 3, 4, and 5, this would be a better country that I live in. Well, that may be, but that's what people talk about all the time. What's your role in that? What do you want to do with what you just said? If Obama were to do A, B, and C, we'd have a better country. Well, maybe I should do A, B, and C in my own life, have a better family. Maybe that's what the meaning of this is. Maybe I should become politically more active, which has very little impact, but has some impact. You have to make some decisions there, and not think that somebody can figure it out for you that's going to make it work. You have very imaginative ideas, very creative ideas. What are you going to do with those creative ideas? So I want to challenge you to immediately step more deeply in how you have to shift the way you use your mind, how you have to shift your worldview, what fundamental decisions you have to make about who you are in order to get to the next step, and what that would take. That's what you do in coaching. That's what you do in changing companies. You see, but we have very little time. So I wonder if anybody would like to venture by saying, I need to, and Anton and I were talking about this in the car, and he knows more about it than I do, but there's a very often quoted poem by Rainer Maria Rilke about the bust of Apollo, which is almost a homosexual statement when you see how he actually writes the poem in German. It's not translated often in quite that way. But he admires that whatever's left of Apollo in that, and he is really mesmerized, as many people who love classical art are, by looking at the incredible achievement of Michelangelo and so on, or imitations of, you know, you go to those fantastic museums that Europe has about that art. And he ends looking at this aesthetic experience. What's he going to do now? And he ends with this remark, ich muss mein Leben verändern. Okay, that's good Flemish, I suppose. I have to shift, I've got to modify who I am. I've got to make some major decision that the person who I am is not sufficiently effective in whatever it is. And I want to get to that part right now, and not tomorrow or what have you. Those decisions, and that's what you do in coaching. What is the real decision now that you're going to have to make to get to the next place? And you can blame the unions, you can blame the government, it's all fine, and that's fine. But then what is the decision? I maybe want to become a journalist and write about those things, and maybe that's what I should do. Or maybe I should become a teacher, a politician, or I may learn from it for myself and my own life. What's your next action step to make you feel you're making an advance by being in this session right now? How much sense am I making right now? Anybody want to come? How much does that mean? Different kind of conversation. What has to shift in who I am? What has to shift in who I choose to be to get to the next level of what I want to be? That's the question that leadership really asks. I wonder whether you have a feeling about that, or an illustration of that in your own life. Where are you right now with your life? What decision needs to be made there? That's not just a conversation that you can have in any coffee shop, but it's a leadership moment, you see. A leadership moment. You can have that here in some way. And anybody wants to say anything at all would be helpful.
Asking question or give your background just shortly to, you know, state your background before and ask your question so that if I get to...
You say you would like to know more about the person.
Yeah.
That's what you said. Would you like to make a comment?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. You go ahead. You've heard two people speak. You've heard me challenge you. Yes, please.
I just realized I need to learn to say no. And that doesn't sound very good in an optimist's meeting, does it? But saying yes to everybody means that you're not actually using your free will to take your own stand on things.
So you're going to tell us now a little bit about the no's. We have a company that's a say no. That is in that way. Maybe tell us a little bit about what in your background, what it means to say no to you. I mean, what are you? It's a very good point that you're making.
I work in training and development in a lot of different areas. I coordinate a small team and I deliver training in things, all of the things that I believe in. So I'm very happy in my work. It's just that everything I do seems to create a wish for more. And there is only so much you can do in all of these different areas.
The wish, okay, first of all, where do you do that teaching? What area are you doing that?
I work in the European institutions in the EU.
You mean government institutions?
Yes.
And can you give us an example of what that means?
I train officials working in the European civil service.
Civil servants.
Yeah, civil servants.
Okay, thank you. Bureaucrats.
Yeah.
You train civil servants in to do what?
In leadership.
And so when you say more, what do you mean by that?
I have a number of different projects.
Yes.
And they're all taking off at the same time.
Oh.
They do what at the same time?
Take off.
They take off. Yeah.
Well, they start at the same time.
Well, they have started, but everything seems to be working.
Do you work in any particular part of the government, in the EU? Is that okay to ask you?
Yeah, it's okay to ask. I'm in an inter-institutional training. It's called the administrative school. So it is a training institute. So training is what we do. And we work with the commission, with the parliament.
So what is your primary message in your teaching?
Two different things. First, we teach the history.
Of
the European integration. Why are we here?
Okay, as a union. Okay.
Yeah. And I think the second message that we give, especially to managers, is that nobody is going to do this for you. You are going to have to act.
And what does it mean for a civil servant to act?
Unfortunately, it means taking on a very rigid system.
Taking on a very, to be an iconoclast, an anarchist.
Yes.
That's what we're having some dealings with the National Health Service in England. That's exactly what they are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's very good what you're saying now. Where's your frustration? Or what is your next step?
The hard thing is deciding what not to do.
Well, what would be an example of what not to do in this case? Not to take on so many projects?
Yeah, because I feel that they are all necessary.
The message that you want to give, the key message, maybe you can give it much more economically, much more powerfully, not necessarily in this context alone. What is your core message? What is the core message? The message so far has been that the people have to understand that Europe wants to be integrated. And I'm a European by birth. I have a German passport. You're saying first that I want to help these people understand the rationale between this union.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is you have a responsibility as a member of the administration to execute that principle.
Mm-hmm.
You have a personal, your job is a personal responsibility to make that happen in ways it doesn't happen right now. And you find that that point of taking personal responsibility for what the job requires, which is a European ideal, is not being discharged. Is that what you're saying? If not, then we need to come to one point that has some depth that is not working here. And what is not working, according to what you've said so far, is that the civil servant looks upon it as a cushy job that has a lot of security, but it is really an idealistic responsibility that they have.
Yes.
And they're discharging that, and you need to say, grow up, understand what you're doing. This is not just a job. This is, you know, just acting like a machine, you know, that's being programmed. You're a human being who's doing something for the European Union. We expect you to do it. That's your job. That's what you get paid for. Is that the message that you think you want to convey?
Yes, much more than.
Okay, then you see the issues we're talking about here are right on target. Then the message that you want to deliver is the message of saying, in the area of courage, we expect you to make decisions that implement the spirit of the European Union. That's your job. In the area of ethics, we expect you to do certain things that have an ethical component that are in the spirit of the European Union. In the area of reality, ethics is the good stuff, the love stuff. Reality is the bad stuff. When things don't go the way you want, when bad people show up and nations don't have the funds, or they can't have a proper budget without a revolution in the country. So what are the reality issues that you, my clients, are facing, and what decisions do you demand of the people who are taking it? And the same thing then with vision. Now, the ultimate issue is that you cannot make those decisions for them. You cannot do anything other than to tell them the truth and challenge them with the fact that it's their decision and the consequences of that decision are their decision. You have to learn very tough talk about the meaning of freedom and responsibility and the consequences of not having that, and be known that you are no nonsense woman when it comes to dealing with those issues. Now that assumes that personally you agree with the principles of the European Union and that you think it's correct that they be challenged to make a commitment, take an oath of allegiance to that particular principle and not become bureaucrats in the sense that they become agents, passive agents of some other forces, which is a very undignified for a human being to exist. That's the issue. But it is not your issue, it's their issue. And as you have heard, as everybody knows in the Patton film, you know, C. Scott, or his name is, the actor, he repeats that part of the West Point speech of this guy who invaded Italy, you know, and brought in the war here after the victory to France in World War II. It's speaking to the West Point graduates, your job is not to die for your country, which is a noble thing to do in the military tradition. Your job is not to die for your country, but to get the other guy to die for his country. And that theme, in a sense, applies here. It's not about you, it's about challenging people to measure up to their potential as human beings who have chosen to lead a life that makes a difference that you believe in and that presumably they believe in by taking on that job. That's a whole different conversation. And what we do here in this in philosophy and business is to find the tools to make those statements with power, those statements with conviction, and make it clear that it's not up to you, it's up to them. And if it doesn't happen, it's not because of you, it's because of them. You don't motivate them like training a lion or a circus animal. They have to make that decision, and you have to confront them very clearly. That is a decision that has to do with the life and death, maybe of the European Union, and so on. But it's a political position that you take, and then you say, that's my job to take it, I have accepted, and I expect that of you as well. And that is a conversation that changes you, that changes them, that changes everything, and it will raise some eyebrows, but that is the truth about the situation that you're saying. And that's exactly what I think we need to understand here. What decisions do you have to make in the courage areas of your life to get your people to make decisions in the courage areas of their lives vis-à-vis the European Union? What decisions do you have to make in your life in the ethical dimension to challenge them when it comes to ethics and collaboration and support and fairness and justice? They have to take an existential stand for the totality here, that's what you challenge them to do. You can lead them there, you can support it, you can talk about it, you can help them, but you can't do it for them. And there can be no illusions. If they don't do it, it doesn't get done. And that's the end of it. And then you may have to take some personal decisions. I don't want to live in a country where people are exploited rather than created. And then you have some very big decisions to make. But that kind of talk, based on those 4 points on the diamond, and we can talk about the others some other day, but those 4 points on the diamond, what change has to occur in you, my student, in how you choose to be in the area of vision, of ideals, of what's possible? What is the shift in you so that you take responsibility for making a difference in that area? That is the depth of the challenge that you need to present to them. And you can do that without all the paraphernalia of a lot of long history. All of that's connected. But to get to that point of self-discovery, that is what works, it's the only thing that works. Unless you think people are trainable animals. They're not trainable. Awaken. You awaken them to their responsibilities. They're citizens. They have just as much power as you do in government elections. So how does it, what happens to you when I talk like that? You know, I talk like that, very hard talk about freedom and responsibility, about how you can make a difference by using these 4 checkpoints. How can you make a difference in courage? How can you make a difference in ethics, in reality, and in vision in their lives? How can challenging them make that, talk about how that would be, and what would be the positive and the negative consequences, and are you ready to make that happen? That is the existential moment, the change moment, the action point, the connection where the rubber meets the road, the connection where a thought becomes a thing, and it is not manufactured by a consultant or a trainer, it's done by the person in the classroom who has to do that. And they learn to talk that way too. And you change the conversation, and you change a culture from passivity to action, and you change the conversation, and you change a culture from paternalism to independent, individual independence, and you change the language, and you change it from exploiting the community. And many of the examples you gave me were of exploitation of the community for personal benefit. And instead, I'm going to make a contribution. And that is Kennedy's famous ending of his inaugural address, which everybody knows because it's such a nice phrase. Don't ask what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. Well, that's a challenge to everyone, you know. Don't ask what your family can do for you. Don't ask what your parents can do for you. Ask what you can do for your parents. And all that. And so you shift the weight of action to where it belongs, and that is to the individual free will. And that's outside of the diamond. The diamond are the tools you use, the checkpoint of what are the issues that I need to deal with. How does that feel? What's happening to you as we get into this kind of serious conversation? Exactly what I think while we're together here. But it's your issue, not mine. And you need to challenge your people that it's their issue, not yours.
It makes eminent sense to me. It makes great sense to me what you're saying. And the word paternalistic that you're using.
Patronizing.
You said paternalistic.
I
sort of was shocked when you said it, but you are right. It is a paternalistic attitude, wanting
paternalism,
to change
yes,
them. Yeah.
Well, that's often what, you see, people who don't take charge of their own lives, but expect others to do it, are, we would say, less developed people than people who say, I will take charge of my own life, and I maybe we want to take charge of your life as well. That's leadership. But to say, I'm suffering and you need to help me, and that's the end of the story, it's not going to get anywhere. Any physician knows that the patient who is resolved to do something about his or her illness will win, and that one who is passive will die.
Mm-hmm.
I will never forget a seminar with nurses. And there was one in California, and there were nurses there in intensive care. And this one nurse said, I have to say something to the group today before we can do anything. Got to say something. I was in intensive care and they brought in two terminal cases. One was a young, healthy guy like you trying to kill himself. Just couldn't try with anybody. He committed suicide and failed. And the other one was an old person like the one we saw in the I saw some really withered man on the advertising. He's like a dried leaf who was fighting for her life. I'm not going to let this cancer, whatever it is, get me. And she said that the young man could easily be saved. There is no interest in it. The old woman, very much harder, very old woman, but she will probably because of her attitude. And every person in emergency medicine knows that people who are actively supporting healing will be better, much faster than those who've given up. You know? And that medicine is, in a great measure, the challenge of what are you prepared to do for your medical condition? You know, what are you prepared to do? That's going to make the difference. All these pills and all that stuff, the AIDS, maybe, is going to make the difference. And a good physician will assess how much willpower do you have, how much will to leave do you have inside you that I can challenge and move along. It's all up to you. It's infinite if you're willing to take it, you see. And that's a universal issue of law. And philosophy can help you to challenge that in people. Now that there are political interests in there, you know. And you mentioned many of them very beautifully, you know. There are political interests and every society is struggling with those two issues. With the love issue of taking care of people who are not taking care of themselves, and another one challenging people to be free and take care of themselves as best they can and be proud of it. Those are two different ways of being democratic. Equality, compassion, love, great, and challenge to be free and active. Yeah. But in terms of what works in your life is if you take care of things yourself. And you then, of course, the system is there to support you as well. But these are the big political issues of the day. And they are the issues in the European Union, then the issues in the United States, in England. This is what politics is made up of, the right and the left. And one is for equality, and is for compassion and taking care of people. And the other one is for challenging people to be to take initiative and be free. And they're both good. They're both equality and freedom are due both in the Marseillaise. Egalité, liberté, you know, they're both in there. They're both values. And that kind of conversation, which is exactly what you get out of this philosophical diamond, changes things to the degree that you can change them. And if it doesn't work, then you decide how to deal with that issue. But don't, and bureaucrats would get in the pejorative terms, would be people who basically feel the security of following the rules, which is fine. They want a simple job in which they do what mechanical stuff. That's fine, nothing wrong with that. But that's not leadership either, you know. That doesn't change things. And you make some personal decisions, who you want to be and how you want to act. And this may be the reason we're here together, to jointly talk about that, because that issue is true for everyone, whatever you're doing. And that is to take your free will and make your target the community, the world in which you live, and use your mind to ask, what in the area of courage can shift in me so that I'm more effective? What in the area of... And then basically you say, I have to get other people to do the same thing I'm doing right now. What do I need to do to be a better person, a more authentic person? And ultimately, my job is to pass that on and challenge someone else. And not that I've done it, but I know how to talk about it, and that helps me too. So we teach people the speech of taking charge of their own lives, pass it on to others who need it. I remember seeing some very poor people in Mexico buying for themselves meaningless little Japanese toys that you wind up and they go around and make some funny things. And they were starving. Kids were sick in bed, needing medicine, and not realizing that their responsibility to use their money otherwise. That doesn't do very much. And being extremely practical, extremely frugal, extremely pragmatic is a fundamental decision of who I am. So that when you talk about people who work in finance, it's all about the question of money and the meaning of life. Anyway, I've made my speech. It's like a church sermon. We have a collection now. And it's essentially to say, I can only tell you that, like every other person, I'm struggling with it, and I can share that struggle with you. I'm grateful that you listen, and ultimately, I invite you to struggle that way too, which of course you do, and you probably can inspire me a lot more than I can inspire you with sharing that struggle. It could be an example. And here's a man who has really struggled throughout his life to build himself. And from a poor boy in Cameroon to a professor of international business with a PhD at Yale University, it's all done by him, all by himself. He did it at the University of Washington and here. And it's, well, if he can do it, I can maybe do it too. And so it's that is a philosophic analysis of the meaning of life, the nature of life. And it's, that's it. And so thank you for having precipitated that. It's all your fault. I've learned to do it. It's your fault. And let's get some more conversation going on this. Anybody who wants to say something, please do, yes.
It's not a personal experience. It's just, I would like to challenge the first part of your speech. You said that we are both individuals and free. And by being individuals, we are stuck with ourselves, we cannot change. You are what you are, you said.
You have a life situation that is much about it that is fixed, right?
Okay.
Including the age at which we are born.
Exactly. Which is a paradox, no? If you're an individual...
Everything is a paradox. The entire diamond is one big polarity. That's right, you got it.
But I don't agree on the fact that we are free. Because of this. Still,
yeah.
As a system,
sure.
We are some of individuals, okay? So I don't see a difference between me as an individual and the system as a sum of single individuals.
You say that one more time so I can hear every word that you say.
The system
yeah.
is made of single individuals,
yeah.
So I don't see a difference between me and the system.
Okay.
Yeah? But then we put the tool, the diamond, and I think that this is where it's after the tool that we are free, it's not before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So by going through the four points of the diamond, you teach us to become free, not to be individuals anymore. And we are not stuck anymore with what we are. Yeah? And at that point, the system being a sum of...
Excuse me. Whatever system is working, yeah.
At that point, the system being the sum of free people
In a human system, you would have like the stock market and an election, right?
At that point, the system would work to be more responsible, more sustainable, ethical. But only, it's not, I wouldn't start by saying that we are free and individuals. Mm-hmm. It's only through the shift in the society, in the vision of the society, that we can become that.
You see, it's extremely important for you to say what you say. In the, of course, we had a luncheon today, and that issue came up. It always comes up, you know, because the free will problem is a big issue. Am I really free, or am I the result of my causes, and so on? And you know the famous expression, cutting the Gordian knot? Alexander the Great, there was, in some place in Greece, there was a chariot attached to something with a knot that was really hard to disentangle. And whoever would be able to disentangle this knot would rule the world. That was a legend. And all the kings and all, they came and they tried to get that knot unraveled. They couldn't do it. It was just too complicated. So Alexander the Great unsheathed his sharp sword and he cut it in half and he says, I opened it up, thus, and he conquered the world. An old story, very famous story. It's called cutting the Gordian knot. So that if all this complication fails, you just cut the Gordian knot. And I said, I don't know what I said that now, but I said at noon, that we just assume that it makes sense to say to you, you're free. And not as something that one person teaches you, but one person may help you discover in yourself. And that is pure Plato. That philosophical knowledge is a recollection of what you already knew. You may need a teacher, like a woman having a baby may need an obstetrician. But the obstetrician doesn't make the baby and doesn't produce the baby, or a midwife. See, Socrates called himself a midwife to truth. And Kierkegaard used the expression, the meiotic method, the Socratic method, of helping the truth to come out of you. It's there to begin with. It doesn't really matter technically of any of that stuff. The fact is that in a living situation, the message that you are free and that you are have much more opportunity to take charge of your life than you dream is the very heart of coaching, the very heart of all forms of psychotherapy, to awaken you to the fact that your freedom is much bigger than you thought it was. And you showed them that diagram, did you not? The free will diagram. Expanding freedom, it's in there, right? Mm-hmm. And you should, so that this is, theoretically, it's one issue. But practically, you cannot do everything you want to do. But that doesn't make you unfree in that you have choices. You always have choices to make that you can make. They may be limited, but you can also make choices that will increase your choosing. Capability. And there's a diagram in there that is very important that deals with that issue. Who can find it? Maybe
is
you
it
can
untangle. What diagram? Is it the Victor diagram, Peter?
No, it's the one, the oval diagram with free will in the middle, and the Ronald May quotation at the bottom. It should be in there somewhere. Maybe it isn't. Yeah.
Oh, it's not.
No.
Not in there. Well, I don't know how much we want to talk about free will, but I am of the opinion. What's your first name?
Corina.
Thank you. I am of the opinion, Corina, that if you make the discussion of free will a central part of an organization, just to bring up the topic. And there's so much said about it in philosophies, so much, so beautiful. If you bring that up, it would do some of the, what's her name?
Anna.
Some of the things that Anna brought up would be answered by having that discussion. I ended our meeting at lunch by reading that quotation from Pico. Is that in there?
Yes. I don't think they have it. Do you have it?
No, I don't.
Here.
Yeah, here.
Yeah, this one.
Okay. Who can read English well here, this group, to read this to the group? Read this out loud, clearly, so we don't miss a single word.
The whole page?
No, just the last paragraph.
The last one.
And I'll set it up for you. I'll set it up, and then if you read it, think, letting every word that you utter enter you so that you know what, that it's not mechanical, but that you know what you're saying with those words. This is probably the most famous statement about freedom and free will in what we might call Western civilization. It's a Renaissance statement written before Columbus discovered America by an Italian arrogant individualist who was in prison for that and died younger than maybe anyone here, 31, he died. It's a great shame. And this is a long piece called, a very famous piece, you can get it any day on the internet, called Oration on the Dignity of Man, meaning thereby human beings. Oration, speech on the dignity of man. And that's the most famous passage. It's an allegory. It's very elaborate. But in this allegory, and what's your first name?
Jean-Christophe.
Jean-Christophe, oh, a famous man. Jean-Christophe, okay. When Jean-Christophe is going to read, is in that allegory there, God speaking to Adam on the day after creation. Come here, Adam. Now that your rib is beginning to heal, you know, where the woman came out of, you know, the stork came out of here. I'm going to explain to you now what I did in creating this world and creating you on the last day. That's a pretty interesting event, you know. And you would say, well, I'm going to pay some attention to what the creator of the universe, the architect of the Big Bang himself, is now speaking. Okay? If the Big Bang was the beginning of the universe, can you imagine the Big Banger? You know what that would be like? Because you can always ask, what was there before the Big Bang? And so here you have God creating the world and Adam and saying, come here, I'm going to tell you what I've done. I've created you in my image, free, a creator, and now I challenge you, as you need to challenge your people and you yours, I challenge you now to make good use of that free will. That doesn't matter if it's true technically or false, it's a great statement. And freedom happens to be a major political ideal all over the world. So it isn't just idle talk, it's not just a footnote. It is maybe the central issue in nations that want to be independent, you know, that want to have their, or maybe the Belgians want to split in two, the Californians they want to split in two, Canada wants to split into the French and the English section. So we are creating worlds. So why don't you read, but with giving it the respect that the topic warrants, and the understanding that it warrants in you to transmit to us, of what God is saying to Adam in those words. Is that enough of a build-up?
Okay. Oh, no question whatsoever. I have placed you at the very center of the world, so that from that vantage point, you may with great ease glance around about on all that the world contains. We've made you a creature neither of heaven nor of earth, neither mortal nor immortal, in order that you may, as the free and proud shaper of your own being, fashion yourself in the form you may prefer. It will be in your power to descend to the lower, brutish forms of life. You will be able, through your own decision, to rise again to the superior orders whose life is divine.
Everybody got it?
Yeah.
Yes, you want me to comment?
I think it's a great belief in the capabilities of the human being to make progress together. Because I think it's the center of the question. We have put this text also in our civic forum as the basic base of our I would say of our work, because there is this belief that the human being is responsible, but that also in his own spirit can do progress to have a better living together. And
you see, this is the real meaning of the conversation we had during the break. And what you're basically saying is use that free will that you have. Don't ignore it. And that isn't caused by my words. You remember it. By his words, you remember it. It awakens something. And you say, hey, now I'm doing sitting. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to amount to something. You know? And I have to be reminded maybe periodically that that's the case. And maybe that is something I can live for and die for. You know? And that's really how that has been taken in the history of mankind. The Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, they're all connected with that theme of being my own person. And we have found that we don't have to be difficult with each other. You know, it's not a threat for everybody to say, I am. If each one of you stood up then and said, I am, you know, trying to imagine what that means, you're not threatening anybody by that. But if you didn't say, but you're not, you know, that's a different matter, you know. It's I am, but you're not. Yeah, that's different. Now, that's very different. And you got to be very careful in communication that you never say that. That you never say, I am. But whether you are not, well, that's still up. The jury hasn't decided yet. You know? That's bad. But people often do that. You know? Let me tell you about myself. And you, well, I'm okay. You're so-so. And we've got to watch that. That's your communication. You have a lot of wisdom in what you say. And this is, it's not all by itself, because people say, what about God? What about the other? Well, that's the system outside too. There's more. But that doesn't change the fact that that is the key to all of it. But you see, the free will is outside of the diamond. The diamond is a checklist of the decisions that you need to make. Make a decision where you stand on courage, a decision where you stand on ethics, a decision where you stand on reality, and a decision where you stand on religion. And then you get to the inner diamond. And so I'm very grateful that we are in this point. But I also want to say we are unfortunate. We need to get further. Maybe we need to take just a little breather, you know, to wake people up. But I think that I want to hear more from you. And nothing specific, except to challenge you to deal with something like that. I'm going to ask you maybe to take 10 minutes now and read those four pages again that are that describe the four points of the diamond. Read those again. And read those questions that you have there, where questions on these four diamond points, and come back with some insight about that. Do some reflecting on those four pages, and then the page with the questions. And if you don't know what pages I refer to, so we can help you with that. And so can I. And then come back and give us some reaction. What's going on with you now at this time that really matters to you? And ultimately, of course, it's a question of how does that apply to business? You see? How does it help you to be better in business? 20% of all the time you spend on character will take care of 80% of the business issues in your company. That's the model. Okay?
Yes, I do. Yeah, it's time after 10 after 9.
Okay.
Peter.
I can introduce it. You have to be very careful. We should ask him.
Yeah, we can ask him.
Let it come.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Spend a lot of time together. You're getting tired, and I think it's heroic to last too long here. And you need these conversations, but maybe not every year at the same time. Like having all your week's meals in one day, doesn't quite work that way. I appreciate it. Now, somebody who hasn't said anything much. Nice to hear from you on anything that you wish to say that you think has real significance to you and your work, you and your career, you and your calling. You have now the basic ingredients there. And I wonder how you feel about that. That was the quote assignment. Yeah, okay. Now you've said a lot, which is wonderful. When we give others an opportunity, why don't you say what you want to say, then we get to you. Please.
Yes. I'm very grateful that you used this text of Pic de la Mirandole about human dignity, because at the University of Louvain-la-Neuve, we use it in anthropology as one of the basic statements about how human beings can make progress in their living together by using their own spirit to have a better living together and respect each other. What means democracy, of course, but also all the institutions that we need to have a better living together. And I think now we are also confronted to a very big challenge, a change of paradigm. There are two or three main, you have, of course, the financial crisis, you have the climate crisis, you have all those different crises, and we believe that there is a common reason for all those crises, and that is an unbalance, what we call in politics a kind of impossibility to make common rules for a world civilization. Specialists now call that acracy and anomy. Anomy means you have no rules. And if you have accuracy means if you have used, you can have them adopted because you have not the power to apply them. And so now we are in a kind of mixed state where the small states like Belgium, even Europe, have no power enough to impose a kind of democratic rule on the world. And so we have to find new rules for the whole humanity, and finding in our common humanity what is the best for us. For example, for climatic change, we are working a lot in devising new products, because we believe there is a fantastic opportunity for our business and our economy to find out new products, because we have to change from the paradigm of oil to the paradigm of sustainable energy and solar energy. And so this needs creativity, but also the help of research teams at the university, think tanks, startups, and all this mix of this intelligent is sometimes difficult to build because everybody is in our business and it's not interconnected, you see. And I think there is a lot of work to do in this diamond also to have a better understanding what the others are doing and how we can help them in their own possibilities. And we call it the way in the labyrinth, because the labyrinth is a kind of, in our mythology, it's a very important way of doing, because you cross people, but you have also doors who are closed, doors who are opened, and we have to find new ways in the labyrinth.
Yes, see, you have an interesting commitment to use the notion of free will for communication and for improving the world. And it's been a life project for you,
yeah,
academic and otherwise. And it's nice to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You want to say something?
Well, yeah, I would like to say, well, first of all, I have to say that I'm pretty familiar with these, with the diamond and all the background, because I had the opportunity to read a lot of the material that Peter put together. So what I would like to share with you is my experience that I realized that you, that the diamond, or like the content of the diamond, my personal content of the diamond changes fundamentally when I change the perspective from which I look at it. My former perspective was that one of an employee of a global operating financial services firm. And if I took, when I took that standpoint, the, like the courage area looked a certain way, and the vision and all these kind of things. And now, that's my actual situation, it's that of an individual who's not anymore embedded in that global operating kind of company, and is asking himself now, what am I doing? And then the courage corner looks totally, that brings totally different aspects to life. Much stronger. And the same with the vision. And so it gets just a totally different kind of, I wouldn't say importance, because it is all also important when you take a look at it from an employer perspective. But I took the decision to get self-employed, and once you take this decision, like the courage thing is like fundamentally different to the one it was when I was employed. So that was just my a quick input.
Can you elaborate? I mean, how do you formulate the questions differently?
Well, let's stay with the courage, because I like you said, you have to, your issue was in the area of courage, and my personal issue, like, well, there are many. I mean, you need to look at the vision thing from a different perspective. But the courage thing is the one that strikes me most, because when I look at taking risk, it's the risk of, can I take that step, and what does it mean to my family? I need to feed my family. That was not the case when I was in a firm. I was responsible, you know, I had a huge budget, but what could happen to me? I mean, if I make a decision that's not, you know, that turns out to be a bad decision, what could happen to me in the worst case? I mean, they probably, well, fire me, I mean, depending on how bad the decision is, but it's just a totally different kind of, the impact is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
When you say, am I going to, first question, am I going to start my business? What does it mean to me? Can I risk it now in the current climate, the economic climate? And a lot of other kind of questions that follow up, like, where am I going to do my business? I live in Switzerland, I'm not Swiss. Do I need to change my base? And so the risk thing is very frightening. And I just realized you need to dive into it, and I wouldn't say play with it, but feel it, reflect on it. And so, yeah.
You smile as you say that.
So, Misa, I'm still alive, and...
maybe if I'm... You know, maybe also, if I was to share the my own personal experience, you know, I remember this was in 2003 when we had this seminar in at the University of Washington back then. And, you know, my discovery, you know, like the aha thing, the aha that happened to you. And I stood up in the middle of the seminar, I said, Peter, are you saying that at the end of the day, I'm on my own? Right, Peter? You remember that? And so ever since, you know, because what we just, what Peter covered here is the outer diamond, you know, maybe. Well, but to me, you know, I took a hard look at the inner diamond. That's the circle that's inside, going deeper, managing polarity, facing the shadow, etc. You know, as I started looking at, you know, philosophy, you know, being African, like, you know, in terms of theoretical education, we are very good. But also, my concern has always been, you know, how do you bring those everything purely theoretical into practice? So when I started applying this methodology, you know, the next thing I knew is I went to my boss and said, you know what, I quit. He looked at me and said, don't be stupid. Salud. You work so hard and we are running all this great program. Indeed, we have a lucrative executive education program and research. And it's so, but I told him, you know what, I quit because my ethic was challenged. And now, maybe I didn't think too much on the reality, saying that, okay, you know, you have a wife and three children, and by quitting, maybe you will lose your green card, because I was 6 months away from my green card in America. So really, you know, when you talk about the hardness of life reality, you are like, okay, do I wait, play it safe, you know, for a few more time and then make the decision, or do I stay consistent and reconcile with myself? You know, because when you start looking at going deep, drilling deeper and saying, okay, from now on I decide not to be lying to myself. And I told him, he's like, okay, wait a minute. You know, here's your 3 months salary, it has been hard, go home, go, just sleep, stay, have a rest. I said, no, I quit. So basically, you know, when you use these lenses that is Peter, you know, the leadership diamond, and you start looking and say, okay, where is my free will? And there are certain questions that nobody can answer to you. And, you know, I think that was one of the best decisions I ever made. Because the next thing I knew is all these universities that came to me, I said, look, we'll work together, but under my term. And it gives you, you know, this sense of saying, okay, I know exactly what I don't want to myself, for myself. Because here I'll be weak, because I cannot cope with it. And we stop lying to ourselves, or, you know, really being, trying to play it the way the society or the community expect us to play it. But it's difficult, you know, to deal with those reality, because at the end of the day, you'll be on your own. Nobody has the formula. And as Peter says, you know, you are stuck with living your life. Nobody will do it.
Can I give another input? It's a bit a different one, not a personal one. But what I find interesting now, well, I can apply the diamond for myself and how I take decisions and things like that. But so as an individual, but I think what's also interesting, and I'm bringing kind of the business back into the game is you can also look at it from an institutional perspective. That's my personal interest as well, like to see how is a company delivering on these four corners. I think that's the really interesting part for me, because and we had I think we had it also about in the last session this today, like these times are really tough times, challenging times, and you can challenge now corporations and apply the diamond on an institutional level and not just on a personal level. So that's just to give it a so that's quite interesting if you go into this, because I think you, Peter, brought up this morning about the BP case, and you could now run the BP case, or you can run it through the diamond, and I think it would be quite interesting to see what's coming out of this. And you could do the same with all the banks and the crisis. About reality and vision and all these things. We had conversations about that. So just want to say you can also bring this institutional perspective into play and not just take it as an individual tool for kind of leadership behavior or leadership training.
Yeah. So you mentioned the inner diamond, but so far we haven't heard about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you briefly explain us what it is about?
Just to give you maybe to talk about the inner diamond, there are two shafts in here that could really explain what the inner diamond. Peter, do you allow me to talk about the inner diamond?
I think that's probably what the group will very much enjoy, since that is an important part of the unfinished business, and it's sort of elegantly moved in that direction. So let's do that, sure.
But very quickly, the inner diamond, as you can see, is a little circle that is in your diamond. So the four point, going deeper. We choose to go deeper. We are not going to be superficial in whatever we are doing. Striving for greatness. We will look always aim for the highest and the best. Facing the shadow, we acknowledge the existence of evil or all the challenge or the resistances, but we are prepared to deal with it. Managing polarity is how do we really deal with all these contradictions that life brings into our faces. Now, so the way to apply this into the diamond is to look at this this one, like the benzene atom with all, okay? So basically what you do is you take the reality part of the outer diamond and you apply the inner diamond component, the different inner diamond component in it. So it allows you to see all the sides of the coin and so on.
Can you give an example of applying the inner diamond to the reality corner? Or ethics, whatever. Just an example, just to...
Okay, yeah, so, Peter talked about principle and compassion.
Yes.
Okay? So, for example, while talking about ethic.
Yes.
Yes. This could be an example
okay.
of... Okay. So, am I going to be too principle, this is the rule, this is how it goes, and so on, or am I going to be compassionate about it?
That's managing the polarity of ethics.
That's managing the polarity of ethics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, then you start looking at what's involved in this, we talk about, the free will, when you look at the ontograph, okay? And on the other part of the system, you have the system. So basically, it's me as individual. Maybe this would join what one of your questions is. Me as individual, you know, taking in account what's around me, you know, what the people, you know, the system that is around me. Okay, so that's when you start going deeper. So. And you do the same with all the different corners. You know, the shadow part, for example, of the ethic is, am I being too ethical? Am I being too much compassionate that I'm ignoring maybe the reality of life and so on? And, so mm-hmm.
And the striving for greatness is going well?
You know, to always look for the excellence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, always. Now, I'll never be content with good, but if I'm able to provide the best and the highest, I will go for it.
But does that mean that, for example, for ethics, you are putting yourself, kind of describe your ideal world, and then try to create, to see the conflicts between where you are today and where you want to go? Or using that that model, is it what it means?
Oh, can you raise?
So basically, if you take, for example, striving for greatness,
okay,
in your ethics,
yes,
does that mean that you want to identify, I don't know, you decide for yourself what you want to be in ethics, and then that you raise some questions to know, well, do I need to go deeper? Do I strive to go even further than what I think I can achieve, or am I completely wrong in the kind of the methods to use to get to there?
Well,
I think you can treat. Now, Peter, you need to correct me if I'm wrong, but you can apply each of these inner diamond kind of corners independently. So, like the greatness area of ethics is like you're really striving for X. What is the ultimate kind of ethical standpoint? But also, in the ethical area, you may come up with, and you have it in one of your other papers, you have also lots of questions under each of these inner diamonds. Like going, but I don't have any in mind now, sorry, I would love to come up with some. But so basically you approach each of these four outer diamond corners, each of them from four different directions, from the greatness area, from the shadow area, from the greatness area, and so you
maybe Peter want to say something.
And I think that's a whole separate chapter. The inner diamond is more of a qualifier of the outer diamond. And I think the issues that you're bringing up are very good. They have an order. We start with deepening. We move on to greatness. We move on to the shadow. And then we move on to polarity. That's sort of the ending. The beginning is courage, and the ending is then polarity. And you will find that it raises a whole new dimension in addressing these diamond points. Take the ethics one, which you just talked about in a minute. We have our leadership space addressing some of the ethical issues that concern you. Relationships, communication, being judged, we feel that you're getting enough attention, that you feel loved and cared about enough, do you feel that you're being treated fairly or you treat people fairly. You examine those issues, all of which are character issues. Now, first of all, you deepen the conversation. You deepen the conversation. And that means essentially, if you have a simple answer, it means maybe you feel treated unfairly. Or maybe, as you have said, that people make special cases of themselves in the inventions. You know, they really want some government support for their creativity, but what they really want is just to have a get some government stipend so they can have a vacation.
rather than to really serve with that sura. You ask yourself, what is fairness? And you like ask it four times. Don't answer a question the first time. First time, and I tell my Kissinger story. Henry Kissinger asked a Rhodes Scholar, the very top reward for being a scholar in the U.S., to write him a position paper for a certain political issue. 3 weeks later, he got that position paper, came back immediately, and Kissinger said, it's not good enough. So he spent 6 weeks rewriting it, really doing a different research, came back the next day, said, it's still really incomplete, you know. And this desperate assistant rewrote it a third time. And he said, I really have done the very, very best that I can possibly produce. If you still don't like it, I just have to quit. Back comes the note from Kissinger, thank you, now I shall read it. In other words, that you don't answer a question the first time, you don't pay much attention to the first time a person says something, you let that person say it more and more, and then you get to some of the real issues. As we did here this afternoon, beginning with Anna, in which the real issue, we don't just talk about the obvious issues. And I made the request, what is the underlying issue there? And I think we got to that, and that's rare, and that's important. The greatness issue is simply that we have the capacity to imagine tremendous greatness. The book that I'm passing around here that I'm leaving in Brussels is called The Inner Side of Greatness. You know? And the heroic, why did Beethoven write so many symphonies? Because he had to improve on the previous one. There's even a recording of his 10th symphony, which very few people have ever heard, and I think it's a blessing not to hear it. It was put together by a musicologist. And the most important one of those is probably the shadow. The shadow in there, which is very, very important in depth psychiatry. The shadow. And the Patty and I went to see a play in the Shakespeare Festival in Oregon, which is quite famous, and they always have another play there as well. And so we saw a play called The Oedipus Complex, and it was about Freud and Oedipus having a conversation, which is pretty bizarre, but very much to the point, you know. And the scene that that makes that such a powerful play was that it starts out with Freud being at the center of a medical amphitheater, dissecting a cadaver, you know, which is what you do in medical school, and all the students are looking. And gradually, that shifted, in which Freud was undergoing a psychoanalysis, and all of the students had a Freud mask. They were simply versions of Freud, judging Freud. Because every time I've been in a psychiatric meeting, which I've attended many, there will be about three or four psychoanalysts who corner me, sit me in the corner, surround me, and interrogate me. You know? And basically, the message that they give is, when I look at you, I give you one message, and that is, I'm sorry, but you're guilty. And you're Kafka, you feel guilty, although you don't know why. There's a dark area that we, it's not necessarily bad, but it's a dark area. Very primitive, maybe. And that comes up, of course, in the Oedipus myth, which is what Oedipus remembers as he's on stage there, that you mean that guy, who that idiot, who didn't let me pass through to go back to my the city of Thebes, that I had a fight with and killed him? That was my father. Oh my God, my father. And now you tell me that my children, you see, I could marry the queen of Thebes, because I solved the riddle of the Sphinx, and I married the queen. And you know, I like women mature. And then I found out that our children were really my brothers. Oh my God! And so there are these very dark thoughts for which Freud was famous. But mythology is full of these strange, dark thoughts. The whole mythology of Greece begins with two feuding brothers who decide finally to reconcile. Very brutal, very primitive. And so they have a nice meal. One of the brothers invites the other one to a good meal, you know, to a good meal. And if you like what you ate, yeah, well, you just ate your children, you know. And that starts in the ultimate feud that is never ending in Greek mythology. And of course, Jung has discovered similarity among these myths. And so there's something else going on in the psyche which comes out in strange archetypes. That's the shadow. And that often is the source of your greatest strength. That is the source of what stops you. And it isn't evil unless you repress it. It is the source of energy and the source of power, the part of you that says, I am. These are the deeper aspects. And then you come to polarity, which is really the fact that everything comes in contradictions. For every idea, there's another equally good idea. Comes in contradictions. And I've made a list of about 50 major, major contradictions in history. Stability and change. The individual and the whole. If you go through Edward Hofstadter's criteria for cultural diversity, individualism versus socialism. Mm-hmm. Is it, you measure societies where they stand on that. The question of masculinity, of course, the gender, the importance of gender differences, high or low, the polarity. In some cultures, genders are indistinguishable. In others, it's hugely important to distinguish them. Then you have the question of how to deal with ambiguity. Some people are very comfortable with ambiguity, so that's absolutely every instant answer. These are these profound personality and culture issues which are built in polarities. And most of the issues of your life are paradoxes and polarities in decisions that you have to make but cannot, because both sides are right. And so we end up by basically saying that the greatest change of conscious state from a person who is still undeveloped to a person who has been developed through the diamond technology, if you want to. It's a new state of consciousness. And it is a state of consciousness in which you don't feel that you have to decide among polarities, but that you ultimately hold them both. God has two hands, and you also need to know which is the correct hand. It doesn't matter. He has two hands, and there's nothing wrong with two hands. You don't feel upset that people have two eyes, and you need a cyclops, two arms, two legs, two lungs, you know, all of that. That's normal, that's two arms, that's normal. And to give up trying to resolve polarities, and people get into arguments, is there free will or is there not free will? Is the individual important or is the group more important? Do you need communication or do you need isolation? Do you need freedom or do you need democracy? Or do you need equality? The fact is people love to get into these arguments, and they never end, because they have they're the nature of reality. They're two opposite sides that are incompatible in one way. The right hand is never going to be the left hand, and vice versa. And we can live with polarities. And the discovery that you can live with conflict, that you can live with paradoxes, is the great invention of democracy. You see, traditionally, you all had to agree. Tyranny, the king made the decisions. Now we have democracy, nobody has to win. You can live the fundamental differences perfectly, happily with each other. That's a change of mind state. And leadership, fundamentally, is to move from a primitive state of mind to a much more sophisticated mind change. And this goes back to Einstein's famous statement, that no problem can be solved at the level of consciousness that created it. You've got to move up a level and then the problem disappears. How many of you have children? How many of you have grandchildren? Okay. You know about stages of development. Your children, certain things your children will not be able to understand until they have lived more. And the issues you worry about today that didn't bother you when you were younger, and the issues that panicked you when you were younger, like how would you be elected class president if people would vote, oh my God, I need to feel that. I identify myself in terms of how other people perceive me. If they like me, I'm good. If they don't like me, I'm not. So you go, oh, it doesn't matter that much. You know? It really doesn't. You know, you can live with it. And so questions that are irresolvable, polarities that are irresolvable when you are younger disappear. They're not resolved, they just disappear. Oh, I was worried about it. Isn't that cute? I was worried about those things. No, I don't. And as you get older, you don't care about the things that bothered you so much earlier. You care about other things. And that's the developmental part. And so polarity is really part of the developmental of a human being. You will find by getting into those other four themes, a great deal of depth is added to your thinking in diamond terms. That's the beginning, the four outer capacities. The inner ways of being ready deepen it enormously and refine it enormously and put a dimension of time and a dimension of maturity to it. This is simply a prescription, these 8 points of how to constantly live in a space for leadership where you get into character issues. And those character issues, they make a big difference in every aspect of your life. And that's a very neat way to get into character issues. And that works. That stops childish behavior, immature behavior, adolescent behavior, and it feels the security of wisdom, of harmony, of depth, of understanding, and you feel, I have a home there. There are answers there. And that's where we want to be. That's what this all adds up to. And it has turned out to be a methodology which, if you follow it, really works well. It really works well to educate a person into maturity, to shoehorn a person into maturity rather quickly. And that's unfinished business when people are in business. That troubles people in business. They fight, they undermine each other, they sabotage, they don't like the work, they get sick. All kinds of stuff that has nothing to do with what a business is all about just undermines it. And you get at those issues and you have a much better business. That's what happens in practice. And I've been doing this since the 60s. You know, I resigned my position in the 80s, but since the 60s, which is 50 years now, of doing this. And it gradually built itself up with a lot of help and a lot of cooperation. And now's the time to spread it more a little, refine it. I work in these concept slides, there are many, and I expect people who work with me to know them and put them together in any way that makes sense, improve them. And so we can really have a speech for you made just out of a few charts, three or four, that address you and not someone else. We're not yet well enough organized, but that's basically what you do, push a few buttons and here, this must speak to you. You brought up free will, you brought up communication. Well, these are the themes that might actually work. And they come from philosophy. And that doesn't have an agenda. You're not sick and have to be cured. You're not a heathen and need to be converted. It doesn't have a hidden agenda. It just is a way of clarifying the mind and its cobwebs, getting rid of the rust, and then it works better. And then you are in charge. Your car has been tuned up. And my God, what a difference. This car is now driving. New tires, new balance. Oh, it smells better too. You know, they put some new car odor inside it. It's a dream. And so the mind gets rusty, gets sclerotic, you know, and needs to be loosened up a little bit. I feel good. And that's sort of what this is all about. So that I guess we ought to conclude now. But the concluding definition of philosophy and business, with which I would like to end, is that leadership, essentially, is the capacity to manage successfully amidst a great variation of worldviews. These bigger images that people have when they analyze what they're saying, the large assumptions that they make about the nature of the world when they make a statement. A leader is a person who doesn't feel it's got to be my way, but your way is this way, your way is that way, your way is this way, my way is this way, and it's okay, they can all work together. We can finagle them so they work. But there's also integrity, that I have, that the all worldviews are aligned. And to be able to maneuver in that system works very well. And the other part is that there's development, that there is, that things change over time. And problems don't always have to be resolved, just stick around, they'll disappear. Those two themes, the diversity of worldviews with integrity, manage those, and knowing that development matures you and leads to some kind of wisdom, which makes a lot of sense. And you combine that, in a sense, with money now. And you say that this is all to address leadership in economics, leadership in global economic health, you know, based on the principle that nations are able to maintain their value system, particularly true in Europe. If you could compare Europe to some of the nations in the Middle East or even the Far East, that Europe, in Europe it is very clear that a nation's capacity to support its value system is a function of its economic competitiveness on the global market. That's how the nations make money. Creativity, innovation, efficiency, effectiveness, deepening. You become competitive in a global sense, and you bring enough in income in to support your value system. And that is a device used by the World Economic Forum in Davos, which everybody knows about in Europe. And their global competitiveness report is just that. It's an attempt to measure nations, about 150 of them, in terms of the global competitiveness. But they use essentially economic measures. They don't use philosophic risk analysis, which they should. The diamond is a way of determining how viable a nation can be, how productive a nation can be, because that energy is behind their social institutions. Many of the complaints that you have that are legitimate, and many of the complaints that the health services have that are legitimate, will go away. And they're bureaucrats, because people are not taking responsibility for themselves to do what they need, what they're getting paid for doing. And if you put all of that together, you have a very neat package of leadership that is very conservative, based on history, and for which there's an enormous amount of literature. It's all there for you. It's considered good quality literature, and it works. And that's really why we're here together. And I hope we compensate it just a little bit for being late. But we weren't really late, and then the traffic, it's all the traffic's fault. You cannot really do any more in Brussels than you can do in Mexico City, unless you have a police escort. You are too. Just traffic is at a standstill. You might as well set up camp, you know where you are. And it took us 1 hour or more, 1 hour and 15 minutes to take a 15-minute trip. How long does it take? About 7 kilometers. Not an hour and a half, you know. So, but you see, just cars just parked there. There's no way to read helicopters to pick one out so they can start moving and get out of the stuck point. Say, thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. And thank you for this golden opportunity that you've given both to my two colleagues, my wife and me, and the sandwiches I could.
Because maybe, I mean, everybody's free to go, but maybe there are some with more questions, and if they want to...
maybe two or three.
Yeah. But if you want, for those who want to go now,
what a good
question
that is, and then let's get to the next.
Yeah.
Follow your advice, you're running this, go ahead.
Some of you have specific question for Peter, or if you prefer that we stop now?
Well, we hope we will survive this, you know. Time will continue, yeah.
Yes.
I see with the corner of my eyes, with the point of view, I can see you here. So I know that, you know, the thought was wall-eyed, and nobody ever knew who was looking at me. Very disconcerting, you know. So here, both of you, please look at me. He said when he was 11, he discovered he was ugly. You know. He also said that he was raised by women, sisters, mothers, aunts, no men. So he never developed a superego. That's why he talked about free will and freedom. There's nobody else who told him with any authority in Alsace-Lorraine what to do. So he grew up with freedom. Buber was abandoned as a little child. So he's always writing about love. Where's mommy? You know, Kierkegaard was terrified when his father, the priest, said, your mother died. And I went to the moors and I did something terrible that's going to visit damnation on our family forever. I cursed God. So Kierkegaard at 11, all he could do is spend the rest of his life writing the best work ever done on anxiety. Now that goes along with you, who said that there are causes, external causes, you see. But those are interesting anecdotes, please.
My question is a little bit to make sure I understand something about your methodology. Is if I understand it right, when we use the words of you draw a map, and if we follow that map, then we will raise a lot of questions in a certain way, and to be sure not to forget some aspects. Right. But you don't really give a method to give answers or to decide. But I think that's okay. I think it's just by raising a lot of questions and not even willing to answer all of them or to be final about one of these answers.
Yeah.
That can give maybe like a higher level of consciousness, and in the end you will know what to do, even if you don't can say this and this is how the answers on that question.
Yeah.
It's more like intuition, and my conclusion would be that in this very complex world that we live in, by raising a lot of questions, we can make sure that the answers comes from our inside somewhere.
See, some questions cannot truly be answered by methodology. And thinking of the judgment of Paris, among the three women goddesses, and were you a handsome man? And when we were young, there were five women who were madly in love with you, and each one said, well, let me marry you. Now you may say, what's the methodology to either say yes to one or to none? How can you pick among them? What's the right methodology? Well, whatever methodology you have used, whatever it is, you have to make a very deep decision about who you are and how you make decisions to deal with that issue, you see? And those are real life issues. And so looking for methodology is an escape from freedom. Freedom is a funny thing. You have to make decisions that you just aren't prepared to make, or that maybe are impossible to make. Don't make it anymore. Okay. Are you married or are you not? Either you're going to die a married man, or you're going to die a man who's never married. There's nothing in between. There may be things in between, but in general, it's an either-or decision. You will have made a decision, one way or the other, whether thoughtfully or not, and we have to learn to grow up to a stage of consciousness in which we can live with that. We can live with this ambiguity and make decisions with anxiety and guilt that we can manage. And you will find that in dealing with life's issues, just thinking about them is a powerful way to take to where you want to go. You want to, a very typical, you are looking for a career. Here is accounting, and here is French literature. Which should it be? Accounting will get you a job right away. French literature will give you great wisdom, by the way. But no money, no wisdom. You know? So how do you choose? Well, you have to feel guilty one way or the other. Maybe it's better to feel guilty about having chosen French literature over accounting than it is to feel guilty having chosen accounting rather than French literature. You might say, Aristotle would say that Socrates says the unexamined life is not worth living. And he says, if the pig is of a different opinion, it's because the pig doesn't know both sides of the question. That's Aristotle's way of saying it. So that there is no methodology, but you have to make decisions anyway. So making a decision is not a naive engineering point. It is an issue that confronts you deeply as a human being, because if you decide to go that way, it's one life, and if you go this way, it's another life. You know? The conquistadores in Latin America, they draw a line, okay, those who are afraid to move into these unexplored lands stay in the back of the line. The rest step forward with me to adventure. And Hernan Cortes in Mexico, he burned his ships and go back. You know? Those are the decisions you make. Are you going to emigrate, if you don't like the country, or are you going to stay there? You know? Those are big decisions, and then there are wrong answers. And to get into conversations about that changes who you are, changes how you talk, how you think. And the way it changes you is that you will trust you rather than be suspicious of your motive. That's the way it works. And thank you for getting us. I'm assuming you did. Those are three questions, actually.
Yes. No more questions? We're all set?
Maybe you have one. You always reverse things. He desperately wants a question. You have one. Maybe. Well, a simple one, like the meaning of life, you know. You may have a question.
He has one.
You have one. No.
You're making a beautiful description of what is human destiny. Yeah? You're going left, you're going right, and so. There is a famous Austrian psychoanalyst, Leopold Sondi, who has described that. He said, we have always to take decisions, and he calls it Pontifex Oppositorum. We have to take decisions in the opposites. And so going further is always being catched in those oppositions. And what you built with going further is your destiny. It's wrong,
that's
it's
good,
but it's your destiny.
Yeah.
And if you have a vision, it's a good destiny. If you have a bad vision, it's a bad destiny. And so I think it's going very deeply philosophy, of course, you are philosophy, but I mean, what it's interesting therein is what we can learn from our own spirit in the different ways the spirit behaves in the directions we take in this destiny.
That is a kind of Hegelian solution.
Yeah.
You have the thesis, antithesis, and you get to work with each other, and out comes a synthesis.
Yeah.
Which is then a real growth, and that is a very well.
Yeah.
That was your question, you see, that you secretly wanted to ask, and you came up with it.
Well, if I have one question which has been basically leading me for the last 30 years, what are we and what am I responsible for? And it's a question I'm constantly asking myself and trying to find answers in philosophy, and all what we do with philosophy and management is probably comes from a need to try to find answers to that question.
You have a conscience. You see, you have a conscience. And many philosophers have taken very seriously the theme that your moral conscience is a cognitive organ. Kant among them. There's some things that you feel strongly are right. And Kant said that you discover those by rational thinking. Many people may simply be indoctrinated, but there's some things that if you violate them, make you feel really bad. And some of that can be what your mother and your father taught you. Something may be inside you. And this is simply what the society expects of you, that would be neurotic guilt. But if it's something that's inside you, that would be authentic guilt. Who has seen here the movie The Dead Poets Society?
Mm-hmm.
It's all about that. It's about a father who was interested in having his son go to the Harvard Law School and go to get all of those prep schools and take all of the courses so he would be admitted at the Harvard Medical School, very prestigious school, so they wanted to make sure he would get in there. And all he wanted to be was a Shakespearean actor, you know. And so secretly he was on the stage, and his father once found out his sinful behavior, that instead of reading the medical books, he was playing some Shakespearean role on the stage. Led to a huge family crisis, and it ended with the son going into his father's study, taking a gun out of the desk and shooting himself, which was then the message that nobody wanted. And you cannot violate the conscience of another person. And that other person ultimately agrees with you to allow you to take over, there will be a very negative reaction to that, because it may be a destiny, and it may be a very important conversation. That's your greatness theme, you know. What is your greatness theme? And Viktor Frankl has a wonderful answer to that. He says, your greatness is to do that one thing that no one else can do. And that often is to deal with people, particular people who may need you more than anyone else, and then to do that task only you can do, you know, like a wife, a husband, or something like that. There's a person, only you can do the job, so your meaning is in doing something that no one else can do. And just looking for that is an interesting search. And service is very important. And there may still be some ways in which you can serve that no one else can. And so you might say that maybe it's a nice way of looking at your destiny. That's what Viktor Frankl said. He discovered logotherapy in a concentration camp in a fabulous book that was voted by the Library of Congress in the United States, the official government library, huge library, one of the 10 best books of the 20th century. And the title of that book was originally From Death Camp to Existentialism. And that's a sexy title. And he said only he can describe that. And so he lived to 95. Yeah. Anyway, I think 3 is a magic number. And we have 1,000 kilometers to go, compressed in what people incorrectly say is 8, you know. But each one is like it's 1,000. You know, you go by the time it takes. And we have to start early in the morning again tomorrow. And it's been a very rich experience with wonderful people, each one being a universe. And I think we should say good night to each other. And we have a driver who's been very, very energetic. And the rest of us help him drive. Go this way, go that way, stop, move faster. He loves it.
Thank you.